Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Davey Wanton, and we'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing Arkansas's White River. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Davey a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Davey Wanton about fly fishing in on Arkansas's White River. Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-the-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call them at 307-237-5997. That's 307-237-5997. Well, before we introduce Davey, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. We'll also be giving away a copy of a book called Home Waters, and this is compiled and published by the Mid-South Fly Fishers. And Home Waters deals with the trout streams and rivers of Arkansas, Tennessee, and southern Missouri, so a nice compliment to the show with Davey tonight. Those will be available through our drawing, and now if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look in the link under Davey's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. Now we'll also be giving away a copy of Davey Wanton's DVD on the White River itself, which is a must-have if you're planning on going down and fishing the White River. So he covers every inch of the tailwaters there. And he'll tell you more about that later, but an outstanding gift. Now, to win that, you'll have to answer the question that we ask at the end of the show. Now, this question's going to be about something that Davey and I talk about during the show, and so pay attention, and it may not always be what you think it's going to be. So pay attention, and if you're the first person to answer it correctly at the end of the show, then you'll win Davey's DVD on the White River. So, okay, well, our guest tonight is Davey Wanton, and Davey's interest in fly fishing started way back in the 50s when he watched his first trout caught by a fly fisherman. To say he was hooked was an understatement. His professional career began in the early 1960s as a professional fly tier. He moved on to manage a mail-order business, developing and manufacturing both fly tying and fly fishing products, one of which was the world-famous SLF series of dubbings. He began writing fly fishing articles in the early 70s and continues to do so. Many of his fly patterns are now currently produced commercially for the world market. He is a consultant to many of the fly fishing organizations around the world. This past 5 years, he's been working in conjunction with Flyfish TV, produced a number of shows for national networks, along with his own series of how-to DVDs. Wet Fly Ways has had a great success, with two other new DVDs to be released this year, Davey's Favorite Flies and The White River. This past August, he also shot a further DVD related to stillwater fly fishing techniques in Montana. Davey was recently awarded in Atlanta the USFW Director of Fisheries Award for Outstanding Voluntary Services Towards Fisheries and Conservation for Services Rendered. He's a popular speaker at fly fishing events around the country and hosts many other fly fishing activities during the year. He will tell you there's no finer place than to be on the water fishing, and despite his professional workload, he still finds time to do plenty of that. His credits for the White River amount to catching a brown trout 25 pounds, 6 ounces, Cutthroat 6-pound 4 ounces, Rainbow 8-pound 2 ounces, and Brook Trout 2-pound 12 ounces. Quite the catch there. Well, Davey, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Pleasure to be with you this evening.
Well, great. Davey, you don't sound like you're from Arkansas.
No. No, originally not. My friends reckon I'm from eastern Arkansas, but no, not really. I'm over there from Wales in the United Kingdom.
And you ended up in Arkansas. Well, what a wonderful place by the White River there.
Oh, yeah.
Couldn't ask for much better fishing there, could you?
No, pretty much not, to be honest about it.
Well, we've got a ton of questions, and since we talked this afternoon, Davey, some more came in advance, so we have plenty to talk about tonight. And, folks, we're going to try to give you an insight as to what the White River is all about and how to fish it and give you some insights. And certainly, as always, we can't cover everything, but we'll also steer you towards some resources that will help you out. Well, Mike Willis in Colorado asked an interesting question. I've never had this asked on any of the shows, Davey, but I thought it was kind of appropriate. He asked, why do you do what you do?
Yeah, that I've been asked that one before.
Oh, have you?
I guess the simple answer to that is quite simply for the love of doing it. That's what it amounts to. I mean, just the intrinsic value of being out there in the natural environment. And fly fishing in particular, it's just something about that you can't really explain that to somebody that doesn't feel or think that way. And I do it because I love it. It's not a profession really at the end of the day that's going to make you a multimillionaire, but you know, that's beside the point really at the end of it. I think that if you do something and you make your profession from it and it's something you thoroughly enjoy and love to do, well, you can't beat that really.
It's a nice place to have your office out there on the water under the trees, and it's much better than a cubicle in some high rise.
that's true too, but you know, sometimes you do have to fish out there with customers in some of the most horrific climatic conditions, and not always pleasurable when you've got 40 mile an hour winds whipping upstream or downstream and rain and cold. And but you know what, every time you catch a fish, it gets that adrenaline going. You kind of disregard the elements that you're in. A day when fishing may be slow and you're in those kind of environment or elements, it's not necessarily so pleasurable. But you know what? At the end of the day, you pretty much forget about everything else that's going around you. You just more concentrate toward fishing because you never know which cast going to produce you a trophy trout. And that's it, you know?
That's it. Yeah, we're always looking for that. Well, another interesting question I wanted to start out with is Marcos in Eugene, Oregon. He says, we all have that landed fish that we will remember for the rest of our lives. Where and how was the one you think of hooked and landed?
You know, that's a good question. You know, we've all joking aside, you know, the hundreds of thousands of fish that I've caught in a fly rod, there's always a small number of those fish that you're never going to forget the issues that related to actually catching that fish and whatever, you know. But I guess, to be honest about it, one particular fish, and ironically, that was down in Chile, was a rainbow that was stationed in a very, very difficult part of the river to get at. And the only way I could actually get to that fish was to stand on a high bank bluff, call it what you like, which itself was something like 40 or 50 feet above the level of the water. And that fish was still 60 to 70 feet, if not more, tucked up to the left side in this backwater bend off the main stream. Anyway, just the fact that I was pretty much able to put that fly right on the nose of that fish and watch him just come out and eat it and then land that fish. To me, that probably, where trout are concerned, was the number one remembrance as far as enabling me to catch what I would consider to be probably the most difficult fish I've ever had to fish for. You know, there's certainly times, you know, when you've got fish that are preoccupied and whatever on a specific food source, and they become, by definition, kind of difficult to catch. But it's kind of a different scenario to that fish, to be perfectly honest about it. So the answer to that question would really be that particular fish down there in southern Chile.
So
and ironically, at that time, Marcus, who actually is a fairly good friend of mine anyway, he was there on that trip at that time, albeit he wasn't there at the time when I caught that fish. But anyway, we had photographic evidence of it, so that's pretty good.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, right. I wonder if he knew that would be the one you would pick. That's you'll have to chat with him later. Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, let's get into the White River here, your home turf here. First of all, we do have an international audience. Davey. So tell the folks where the White River is in the United States so they can get a mental picture of that.
Well, it's pretty much based on the northern region of Arkansas, just south of the Missouri border. And a White River system is a system which is, by definition, a tailwater system. Back in the late 40s and early 50s, the Corps of Engineers were instructed to construct dams for primarily the purposes of flood control. And, of course, thereafter, once they essentially dammed up what was at that time, to all intents and purposes, a warm water fishery environment, that enabled, from that point onwards, cold water to be released from the lakes above, and that, of course, ended up resulting in the fact that a cold water environment, known as a tailwater, became suitable for the habitat of trout, i.e. cold water species. So essentially, that's how it came about initially.
Now, this is a quite extensive river system, as I understand it. Are there particular sections that you fish most often or would have somebody focus on if they were going down there?
You know, the White River system is an interesting river because it actually starts more so in the western part of Arkansas, and it kind of travels up north. It goes up into the state of Missouri, and then it comes back down again into Arkansas. And there are a number of dam systems along the course of what is defined as the tailwater system. I essentially pretty much relate most of my fishing activity to the section which is below Bull Shoals Dam, which pretty much amounts to near around about 90 miles of continuous water on the White River system and approximately 5 miles of tailwater from the Norfolk River, which is a short section that is also dammed that runs into the White River system at 40 miles down from the Bull Shoals Dam. So, yes, you've got an amazing amount of water out there to resource, and there are absolutely no restrictions for you to be able to do that. To all intents and purposes, the Corps of Engineers own the river, if that's the way to explain one to you, and there's no restrictions so far as access, at least, shall we say, below the high water mark. The Arkansas Game and Fish Commission really are primarily responsible for providing the access to the river by definition of concrete boat ramps and this, that, and other. And there are a lot of what we call trout docks or resorts along the river that enable people to access the river directly in front of those. Other than that, you know, where other human habitation exists along the river, you would either have to know the owner of that property to access the river directly from that point. But saying that, the main access points are approximately in the upper section of the river between roughly 6 to 7 miles apart. Generally speaking, most people access that river with a boat, to be honest about it, albeit a lot of the more popular areas of the river, particularly, say, Bull Shoals Dam, the entirety of the Norfolk River, Rim Shoals, for example, they're very, very popular walking wade access points and also provide very good fishing at those access points, too.
So it sounds like the water rights are similar to Montana, where as long as you stay below the high water mark, you're okay. In other words, if you can walk up from an access point and be, in essence, in front of private property, but you're still able to fish there.
You can fish anywhere on the White River system below the high water mark. In other words, legally, if you accessed the river with consent and permission from a landowner, no issue. But if you did that without, then, of course, that would be an issue. But saying that, to all intents and purposes, the accessibility that this river affords is pretty darn good. I mean, there's no question of the fact that you're going to get, you know, written up for being somewhere on that river system. Certain places out west, as you well know, you can't even get out of a boat. Well, that's
right.
Not the case here. You know,
you
can take a boat on that river. You can use it to access upstream or downstream. You can get out that boat, wade fish, and pretty much you have total freedom of access on our river systems.
Good, good. Now, how far from Bull Shoals down river, how many miles of that is really good fishable river? I mean, I know the tailwaters kind of peter out, you know, in quality as time goes on. So,
well, the only thing that largely affects that is if we see situations on a possibly a drought year where we have minimal amount of generation and or water release, and bear in mind that Bull Shoals Dam is a big dam. It can generate something in the region of 24,000 CFS of water if it is the 8 gates open at one point in time. That tends to maintain, and also I might add the influence of the Norfolk River system also, which is 40 miles down, that tends to maintain a cold water environment. We have two other major systems that run in to the White River, which are by definition during the summer months, warm water environments. And to just say this to you, that somewhere in the region of about possibly 60 miles from Bull Shoals downstream, if we saw a year where we saw very low water and lower levels of generation, the probability is that the warm water would encourage those fish to move more upstream into the colder water environments. But to all intensive purposes, pretty much trout will survive pretty darn well within 90 miles of the White River from Bull Shoals downstream.
That's a lot of river.
Yes,
that's
it is.
A lot of river.
Yes, it is.
I mean, a lot of the western, you know, tailwaters, you know, you're lucky if you get 12, 15 miles of quality water. So that's very exciting. You had mentioned the North Fork, and there was a question, a couple of questions, and they referred to the North Fork, asking is the North Fork River part of the White River system? And then another person, and I'll read this in a second, but clarify North Fork versus Norfolk for us in that area.
Yeah, okay. The North Fork of the White River is a natural river system, which is a spring-fed river system, which starts up in Missouri. And actually, the lower it gets, by today's standards anyway, it becomes more of a warm water environment. However, it then is run into what is now known as the Norfolk Lake, which is spelled slightly differently, which is then dammed. And then thereafter, of course, that produces the Norfolk tailwater system of approximately 5 miles long.
Okay.
The upper section of that particular river in Missouri, I might add, is probably one of the best natural trout streams in the United States, in my opinion. It's not a river that's, shall we say, intensively fished, but the fish there are extremely tough to catch by comparison to a lot of other places. As a natural reproduction of what was a cross-strain of McLeod rainbows in that river, it has a good natural reproduction of brown trout, as well as supplement stocks of brown trout introduced into it. Whereas if you come down below the Norfolk Dam into the Norfolk River system here in Arkansas, well, that's kind of a different scenario. It does have some natural reproduction, but by and large, the White River tailwater system is to some extent very much reliant more so on fish being introduced, albeit they can grow and, as you well know, attain, in the case of brown trout, monstrous sizes, 20,
right,
30 pounds fish.
Well, now, you have the questions there that came in advance, and you see the one by Christopher Morris there in Flippin, Arkansas.
Mm.
And he's referring to the North Fork. Is he referring to the section below the Norfolk Lake in that section, do you believe?
Yeah, what he's saying here, you see, there's two ways of spelling that. It's the North Fork and Norfolk.
Okay, so they're one in the same, then, in essence.
No.
Oh, okay. No,
the one definition is the river system up in Missouri. The other one is the tailwater system below
okay.
the dam in Arkansas. And the way that the question was written more so relates to the system up in Missouri.
Oh, okay. We'll let that question pass on by because we want to stay focused here on the White River. But
right.
I just wanted to clarify that because it was confusing to me as well. The two systems there.
Well, let me just say this, that the manner in which Chris has asked of this question does more so relate to the tailwater system of the Norfolk River here in Arkansas.
Okay,
So we could answer some of those questions.
Sure, yeah. He's talking about fishing pressure. He said when he was fishing there, he could catch all four species in 1 hour, which is...
Yeah.
Left him kind of speechless, but he
yeah.
says there's, you know, a problem with pressure there on the North Fork, and he's, you know, wondering if there's what's being done about that, if anything.
Yeah, well, let me just say this, that you have to realize here that we are dealing with tailwater systems, and in consequence of that, when water is being generated on one or the other rivers, it may not be viable for people to access those rivers to wade fish. So in consequence of that, for example, if the White River was running high water generation and the Norfolk River had zero, then the odds are people who chose to want to wade fish would obviously go over to the Norfolk River. And in consequence of that, you may well see, you know, a considerable amount of pressure for that relatively short section of water during that period of time. So far as, you know, restrictions or whatever to limit the amount of persons that fish there at any one point in time, I honestly don't know how you could do that. The Arkansas Game and Fish Commission are very much responsible for fisheries management, enforcement, and other issues that relate to the well-being of the systems. But how would you bring about an issue where you could say, okay, we're only going to allow 50 people here to fish today, and anyone else that shows up thereafter, you can't do it? Well, I don't know how they could even bring that about. You know, you have to accept, I guess, nationally, really, a lot of our rivers do see immense amount of pressure. I mean, I've fished pretty much all over the United States, and certainly I've been to places out west. The San Juan is a typical example. I mean, you talk about hundreds of people crowded into relatively small zones, and I mean, it's massive pressure. But to be honest about it, I would say by and large, if you take an average year on the White River system, including the Norfolk, you have more than enough freedom and resource to go somewhere where you don't necessarily have to fish amongst the crowds. The only thing that largely restricts that to some extent is A, high water generations, which means that in that sense you've got to pretty much fish out of a boat, and or access to certain areas which you can't get to other than with a boat. So you do tend to find at certain times of the year higher levels of concentration of anglers fishing in certain zones than you would at others. But by and large, I would say if you take the year on an average basis and you know the river systems, you can move around from one to the other and largely, you know, be at peace by yourself most of the time, but okay. Not always.
Well, we'll talk more about wading and floating here in a minute, but
sure.
A couple more details about the river. What species or fish are in the river, and which ones do you target primarily on the fly?
Okay. We have four species stocked in the river system. We have brown trout, rainbow trout, brook trout, and Snake River cutthroat. And I would just explain that a little bit further. The Arkansas Game and Fish Commission have a mandatory requirement with the Norfolk National Fish Hatchery, and themselves also, to introduce rainbow trout at approximately 11 inches in size. And by definition of that, they determine that that's a sizable fish for people, if they choose to want to do it, to harvest those fish. Because don't forget, the White River system is not exclusively a fly fishing mecca. It incorporates all means or methods of fishing which are legal or otherwise in certain zones. So trophy zones, for example, restrict only the use of artificials, whereas outside of trophy zones, anglers could fish with bait if they so choose, and they can harvest fish there. In the case of brook trout, cutthroat, and brown trout, we also stock those into the system, but they're stocked as small fish, on average 5 to 7 inches, which of course enables a potential of those fish to survive and grow large, which in certain circumstances they do. It also, to some extent, eliminates excessive amount of harvest with those smaller fish, because first and foremost, they're below the legal size limits for you to harvest in the first place. So we do get a carryover of the smaller fish that are stocked into the river. But by and large, what you're looking at is something in the region of around 2 million trout or more a year introduced into the White River system in Arkansas.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot of fish.
Do they have any numbers on fish harvested?
Yeah, you know, the Game and Fish Commission have, shall we say, surveys. And what they try to establish is that per angler hour fishing the systems, that if my memory serves me right, it works out something in the region of about 1.2, 1.3 fish per hour angler fished, which if you take over on a national average on a trout fishery, that's pretty high. I mean, I can tell you from experience, you know, it's not uncommon for us to take, you know, two customers out there and maybe two guys that don't have a great deal of fly fishing skill. And they'll end up with a day of 40, 50, 60 fish, and in some cases 80 or 100 or more. It just really depends on the time of the year and just how things are. So it is the river system that, by and large, does enable you to catch a large numbers of fish, but also enables you potentially to catch a fish of a lifetime.
Right.
And that's often the case. You know, you may have a day where you catch, you know, a high percentage of average trout, 12 to 14 inches, you get a few 15, 16, 17s, and then somebody's going to nail a fish of maybe 10 or 11 or 12 pounds. You just never know.
Well, I was going to ask you, and the next question was, what makes the White River so legendary? I think you just answered it.
Oh.
If you want to expand upon that.
Yeah, well, you know, historically, they first actually stocked trout into the short section of the Norfolk River, because that was the first system that was dammed in late 1940s. And within a couple of years, you know, the trout growth there was phenomenal. I mean, fish of 6-8 pounds were just not uncommon. Once Bull Shoals Dam had been constructed, the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission also surveyed that and studied it to a point where they realized, well, hey, you know, this is also another viable system for us to stock trout, and they did that too. So in the early years, growth rates were phenomenal, but also related to that, there wasn't the fishing pressure, and therefore survival rates were longer, and therefore overall, there were percentage-wise more larger fish in the river. At that time, particularly rainbow trout, it was not uncommon for guys to go out there and come in with a string of rainbows, 6, 8, 10, 12, 15 pounds. Quite unbelievable. What then took place, more so, was over a period of time, as we largely see it today, was that by far, brown trout have become predominant so far as the larger species are concerned. And that doesn't surprise me in the slightest, because their food base out there that enables them to do that. I mean, they eat rainbow trout, that's the first thing, but then they've got a massive abundance of other food sources that enable them to do that. Sculpins, crawdads, various other species of freshwater fish that are in that system. So by and large, let me just say this, the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission, and most of us who fish this river system today, treat this as probably the number one trophy brown trout fishery in the United States by definition of the fact the percentage of fish that it produces that are by what we determine as trophy-sized trout. And everybody has a different perspective of that, too. You may fish a river system where a fish of 15 inches would be considered a trophy trout.
Right.
Here, a 20-inch brown trout is not unusual. It's a common occurrence. But then, on the other hand, you're looking at fish 25, 30 inches to 35 inches. Well, they're there. Yeah, you just gotta catch them.
Yeah. Well, David, we have to take a short break here, but when we come back, we'll dig into some more of this. This is exciting. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. Were you listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio? We're talking with Davey Wanton about fly fishing Arkansas's White River. So if you'd like to ask Davey a question, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Davey, before we jump back into the White River, why don't you tell us a little bit about your business and what you do and what you're doing in the fly fishing world recently?
Yeah. Oh, well, I operate an outfitter and guide service here on the White River system, and as you said to the listeners here earlier on, you know, I still travel around the United States and provide programs, educational, instructional, whatever, at different fly fishing events, individual associations, you know, clubs, federation, fly fishers clubs, TU, whatever, and give programs. I still work on the basis of developing new fly patterns. I guess that's something, if you fly fishing, you're always going to do. You always think there's something out there that's going to be the number one fly and you never need another one. Well, you know what? There's some flies that are pretty close to that, but there's never no 100% answer. In many cases, experience has taught me this, that each and every river system you fish has got its own specific, I wouldn't call them peculiarities, but you know, just the habitat and the nature of those fish, the food base and various other issues demand a different approach to effectively catch those fish. And that's always fascinated me, you know, because if I was to make, say, for example, a comparison of the brown trout that live over there in, say, Ireland, for example, in the Great Irish Limestone Locks, and you make the comparison between the brown trout that you find here in the White River system, they have very similar habits, but their food, the way they feed is different, but also the techniques and flies that you use to catch those fish are also somewhat different. Not necessarily totally, but they're that's how I look at it, you know. So that's just part of fly fishing, I guess. You're always thinking about, what can I do to make it better? You know, is there a golden answer to this? Is there to that? But I think, and it's a question I get asked often, and my answer would be to anybody that asked me that question, is this. The more years of experience you have, the more you fish, the more you understand the quarry you pursue it and its habits, the more fish ultimately you'll catch at the end of the day. It's not a quick, easy learning experience, and I think that's a big part of what makes fly fishing so much fun, regardless of whatever species you fish for.
Right, right. Now, what is your website address if people want to find out more about your business?
Sure. Yeah, my website is davywotton.com.
Okay, and that is davywotton.com, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. That's correct, yes. And we also offer there some of my specialist ranges of flies that you just don't find in your regular stores out there, and things of that nature. And
especially the ones that catch the trophy browns in the White River, right?
Yeah, you know, I don't know whether you really wanted to get to discussing the issue about, you know, those big fish right now or not, but...
Sure.
Yeah, if you do. Let me just say this, that these big brown trout in this river system can be caught on exceptionally small flies, and they can also be caught on 6-inch streamers. A lot of the big brown trout, and when I say big brown trout, I'm referring to fish that are any, you know, weight-wise 3, 6, 7, 8, 9 pounds, and maybe more at times, you will catch on small flies, small chironomids, sowbugs, scuds, flies of that nature. On the other hand, there are certain times of the year where those fish generally don't feed on that food base, because first and foremost, most anglers would generally fish flies of that nature in daylight hours. Those fish largely move over to more nocturnal feeding activity, and therefore, and I'm not saying it's not possible to catch fish on small flies at night, because it is, but by and large, it wouldn't be the technique you would opt to use. You would generally be fishing larger flies that represent sculpins and larger food sources that those fish are looking for, because they travel. They move up or downstream in a feeding, what we call a feeding zone, and you've just got to put that fly there at the right time. So the answer really is that there is never no one fly that I would tell you or anyone is the golden answer to catching those trophy brown trout that are in this system.
Well, I'd like to come back to the flies and go into that in a little bit more detail.
Yeah.
But there's a couple of things I think we need to get through before we get there. But that's a little teaser for folks. And I think that's you've kind of said it clearly, is there's a lot of conditions and times of year and food sources that all determine what fly is going to get that fish. But we did a question. Anthony Naples from Pittsburgh says, I like to walk weight mostly as opposed to floating. Is there a time of year that is better for weight fishing on the white?
Well, the answer to that question is quite simply this. We are totally at the mercy of water release. In other words, water is released from these dams for two purposes. One is flood control. The other one is for hydropower generation. And therefore, I won't get into it too much, but it pretty much amounts to that. If water is being released for generation purposes, that's one issue. If it's been released for flood control, that's another, but it could actually be released for the two purposes at the same time. So therefore, I or no one else can really give you a really good prediction about at such and such a time we're likely to see no generation or
right.
High generation, because it's very much dependent on those two issues, and it's also related to the amount of water that's been contained in the lakes above the dams, because they have certain stages of water that are considered pool stage, and flood stage, and there's an intermediate between that. And so the release of water is determined by, at certain times, A, the Corps of Engineers, and or Southwest Power.
Well, and I know from a river system that long, it could also depend on where you're on the river, because if they're releasing water at Bull Shoals Dam at 9 in the morning, I suppose that's not going to, you know, even affect the water that's 40 miles downriver for quite a while.
Well, that was the other thing I was going to just tell you, was that dependent on what level of generation or not, or has taken place or has not, you can determine at given points down that river how long that water is going to reach you or how long it's going to take before it does reach you. And secondly, how long it's going to take for it to fall out if they cease generation. And you can call the dam here and get up-to-date information of what generation is taking place and to some extent what has preceded that. You can also go to a website and get further information that will give you information that goes back a good number of hours. And essentially that's how we act here, you know, so far as our guide activity is concerned. We need to know what has taken place, what is taking place, because by and large that determines the best options for fishing that day. In some cases, you on the river, rising water is good water. You know, fish feed real good when the water rises. In other zones on the river, they feed better when the water's actually falling out. So within the section of, or shall we say, the entirety of the White River system, rise and or fall of water does largely determine fish behavior, whether they're going to feed good or whether they're not. If you have a continuous low water scenario, well, of course, that's another scenario altogether, because that tends to concentrate fish into zones on the river where maybe there's more water, there's more oxygenated water, particularly more so in the warmer summer months and things like that. So all these things are taken into consideration when we choose to go to fish on any given day out here on the White River system.
Okay. Now, a couple of questions. I'm going to kind of combine these. Paul in Basalt, Colorado, wants to know if you can float this river. If so, if there are maps available. And then Dave Fritz from Georgia also says, I've heard there's a lot of wadeable access, but that you pretty much have to hire a guide to run you up and down the river. So can you talk about floating and those,
yeah,
those takeout and put in places?
Okay. There are, first and foremost, some very good maps available out there. And in fact, in the White River DVD that I did, if you obtain that DVD, in that there is a map, and there is also in there a time schedule that tells you approximately at what point of time water is reached at certain mileage sections as you move down that river system. So that gives you a lot of information there where that one's concerned. But to all intents and purposes, there's absolutely total freedom of access to boat or navigate on this river, upstream and or downstream. And like we said previously, there are a lot of points provided by the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission along the river system that enable you to launch a boat, park up, and return back to the same boat ramp and get your boat back out the water. However, when we have a low water scenario, very, very low water scenario, the options to navigate upstream are, in some areas of the river system are not that good. In fact, you would have to get out the boat and pretty much drag it upstream. In some cases, you won't even do that. So in situations where we have exceptionally low water, pretty much your options are a downstream float, and you would have to obviously get yourself a shuttle or work with a couple of other guys. We've both got vehicles to enable you to start at point A and get out at point B. But there is no restriction so far as access, so to speak, from the designated points and float in this entire river system. And there is no restriction, I might add, which is very strange, to the size of outboard engine that you choose to use.
But as I understand about doing a bit of reading, that there have been some specific John boats that have been developed for the White River for the issues that you just talked about. Can you talk about those boats?
Yeah, sure. They're kind of unique. Boats that we use out here typically are 21 feet long. And they vary in width, depending on what model of boat you have. They could be anything from, you know, 3 to 4 feet in bottom width up to maybe 5 or 6 feet. And we generally run those with, on average, probably most people would use a 15-horsepower motor on average water conditions. And if we have high water situations, then we probably up that to a 25-horsepower because we're pushing against some pretty fast water. It could be as much as 12 or 40 miles an hour flow rate when we get big-time water. So, that's absolutely right. They're flat-bottom boats, and they draft real, real shallow. And if you really know what you're doing out there, you'd be surprised how skinny a water you can run one of those boats up with an outboard motor. Some people choose to use jet motors. I'm not a great lover of those, to be honest about it.
Okay. Now, for a lot of us out west that we use a lot of drift boats, are those feasible for the White River, or should you really have a power boat?
Absolutely, yeah. Some of my guide friends choose to use drift boats when they fish this river system. Certainly, you know, when you're running on big water, it might not be you know, maybe sometimes the easiest thing to do, because as you well know, a river moving at 12 or 40 miles an hour tends to move you downstream pretty fast too. The advantage with the motor is that you can course fish a productive zone and you can go way upstream above it and then fish it back down again. It ain't too easy to row a drift boat against 12 miles of water.
No.
No.
Yeah. Well, good. So, so it sounds like, even though a drift boat is feasible for that, that your best fishing is maybe going to come from that ability to move up and down the river at will.
If you take generally across the board, mind you, I might add, a lot of people use personal watercraft too. You know, I mean, they use canoes, they use kayaks, they use pontoons, whatever.
Oh, okay.
And so what they do is they arrange to put in at one point and then they drift backstream. Most, you know, a lot of the outfitters here on the river are pretty accommodating as far as that's concerned. You know, if you're staying at their lodge and you want to fish, say, from an upstream point back down to where they are based on the river, they'll take you upstream so you can run a float of whatever you want, 10, 12, 15, 20 miles and have a good day doing that. And a lot of people do that, and that's fun. I've done it myself also. And what they do is they just float downstream. Maybe they stop off and wait this shoal. A shoal is an Arkansas term, by the way, for a riffle, strange enough.
Okay.
And then they just gradually work their way downstream. That's a fun way to fish the river. I think to some extent, and I have to admit this, that when you're out there in a boat, you tend to dismiss a lot of zones, which you know very well are good holding zones, purely because you're out sitting in a boat, and that's just how it is, you know. What I tend to do when I have more of a lower water scenario here, which provides good wade access, is to use the boat and get it, or take the customers to where we want to fish, and we get out and we're wade fish and we get in the boat and we'll either go upstream or downstream. And so what we do is just use the resource of the boat to enable us to get to where we want to get to, because
sure,
some places you can't get to otherwise.
Right, right.
Mm.
Well, David, we need to take another quick break, and then we'll come back and talk more about fishing the White River.
Sure.
At Housatonic River Outfitters, we offer the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with our guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, we offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing guide trips for warm water species. Please tour our website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services we offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. We were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services, and we have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Davey Wanton about fly fishing Arkansas's White River. If you'd like to ask Davey a question, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And I do, even though I said that, I have to warn everybody, we're really overwhelmed at this point with questions, and we may or may not get to them, but we sure appreciate you sending them in. Now, Davey, I'm going to try to we had a whole bunch of questions from people all the way from South Dakota to Hurricane Utah to Patagonia, Argentina to Rowlett, Texas, and Ontario, Canada, and a lot and many other places, all asking about the best time to come down and fish the White River. And so could you speak to that? Because, you know, I've got one person coming in April, one in May, one in June. So if you could generally talk about it. And maybe Ralph in Texas did want to know about the spawning seasons and whether, you know, those were good times to fish or not. So could you address the seasonal activity down there?
Yeah, sure. First and foremost, you can fish the White River 365 days a year. The only restriction is Bull Shoals Dam during the spawning season, and that's closed November, December, January, and opens in the 1st of February, as it's just done. Other than that, you have freedom of access to fish the river 365 days a year. Now, so far as best times of the year, let me just say this. There's not a day in the year that you cannot go out on that river and catch a bunch of fish, and in all probability, a big fish as well. It's given the fact that it's a tailwater system, the majority of the food base in this river system is crustaceans. That's the first thing, which, of course, includes sow bugs, scuds, crayfish, and then baitfish, and, of course, in the case of the larger brown trout, amongst other things else. So far as hatches is concerned, by and large, the predominant hatch we have here are caddis. And ironically, I was out fishing on this Sunday, and I saw some granums just, it's about 20 granums. That's pretty early for them. But typically what you're looking at is somewhere between about mid-March, April, and into May. And then we get some mayfly hatches, primarily sulfur species, PMDs and that. And so you'll get some surface activity there. And then we have coronamids, massive amounts of coronamids. And typically in a low water scenario, if you were fishing the Norfolk River, for example, or bull shoals down, most of your day is going to be taken up fishing small coronamids, midge pupa, or midges, people generally call them here, to surface feeding fish or fish which are just scooting around in the shallow zones looking for that food base. It is a unique system in many ways compared to a lot of the rivers out west for different reasons. Like I said, you know, the main food base here is crustaceans. It doesn't have big mayfly hatches. And so you orientate your fishing activity to what it is the food source is primarily the fish feed on, which is on or near the bed of the river most of the time. That's not to say that if you see no surface activity, you can't fish techniques that will bring fish up to the surface and eat flies off the surface because they will. You just have the right parameters of water at that time to enable that to happen. And 8 generators of water flowing down there is not generally conducive to that. However, I will tell you from experience that if you're an angler that likes to work shorelines fishing hoppers and larger dry flies, you'd be surprised the number of fish that you can catch doing that, because they tend to hug more so closer into the shorelines than the main force of river water out there in the middle of the river. So you can often catch some very, very big fish doing that. And so far as spawning is concerned, well, let me just say this. Personally, I will not choose to fish for brown trout or rainbow trout when they're actually on reds spawning. I personally believe they should be left alone at that point of time. However, they're fair game when they move up the river system. And to all intents and purposes, where the brown trout are concerned, largely we start to see that happening, actually, ironically, toward the end of August and into September and October. And you have a very, very good chance of catching a big trout at that particular time. They tend to, particularly in brown trout, anyway, tend to become a little bit more aggressive. They're territorial, as you pretty much know anyway, and every time they move into a new territory, they're kind of looking around and something aggravates them, boom, you know, they'll probably eat it, chase it off, or do something or other. So you have a very good chance to catch a very big fish at that time. At a later point of time, typically November, more so mid-November, early part of December, they tend to be mild concentrated in certain shallow water zones over gravel bars or whatever, where they dig their reds and they spawn. And as far as the rainbow trout are concerned, well, I could talk an awful long time about that one, because what we're really dealing with today is this. Hatchery-raised fish, by and large, have been to some extent cultured in to such an extent that they are capable of spawning at any time of the year. However, whether they can do so successfully is another story. You know, rainbow trout naturally spawn in the springtime, depending on the river system they're in. Here on our river system, you can see them going through the motions of doing that. And possibly on the Little Red River system, which is another Arkansas tailwater, they do actually spawn successfully. I would say that the actual survival rate of rainbow trout that go through the process of spawning on the White River system is very, very minimal, to be honest about it. That's not to say that we don't get fish that, you know, survive and grow to fairly large proportions, because we do. So the answer to the question really is that, A, you can fish the river 365 days a year. You have a chance every one of those days to catch a trophy trout, a big fish, be it a brown trout or a rainbow, a cutthroat, or a brook trout. But primarily, most of the big brown trout are likely to be caught during the months of September, October, November, and possibly December. The earlier part of the year, January and February, most of the food base is dormant in the river system, and brown trout, after the rigors of spawning, kind of quieten down some. Once we start moving into March, food base starts to become more active. They start to become more active, they can be extremely aggressive toward lesser forms of life at that time. And March, April, and May is a really good time also to get yourself a big trout. And often as not, you may well catch them on the surface when they're coming up and eating caddis, either pupa or adults, either one.
Good. Let's talk a little bit about, we had a question from Frank Wood on what's your favorite tackle for the river? How do you rig up for the White River if you're coming down there?
If I was to give a general answer to that question, it would be this. Most of the time, if you have a rod of 9 foot, 10 foot that accommodates a 5-weight line for probably 80% of the fishing that you would need to do here, that will serve your purpose. Whether it's nymph fishing, smaller streamers, dry fly fishing, wet fly, soft tackles. If you go above and below that, then we're dealing with different situations. For example, if we were fishing large streamers, and with sinking lines or sink tips, then a 5-weight's pushing it. You'd probably be looking more so for at least a good stiff 6-weight or even a 7. And sometimes I might use an 8-weight. We do have a situation here, incidentally, which I forgot to tell you, was that often as not, if we see exceptionally cold conditions, as you well know, we've had a serious ice storm here recently, the shad in the lakes tend to get stunned. And if we had the right generation, of course, they get pushed through the generator systems into the river below. And bull shoals down can provide you with some of the most unbelievable trout fishing to catch big trout if there's a shad kill. I mean, those fish just go nuts. And you can catch off the surface huge trout. I mean, huge trout. I'm not saying you're necessarily going to land them, but you're going to see them. Boy, they'll get your adrenaline going in a hurry. I've personally seen brown trout there come up to the surface in excess of 20 pounds in weight or more, eating these shad as they're coming through the dam system. But it's one of those things, you know, people call up all the time and say, hey, we want to come and fish a shad kill. Well, I know. I'll say to them, well, you know what? You could come down here and you could fish every day during the month of February, for example, and never see it happen. But the day you left, there could be a really good shad kill. You never know from one day to the next whether or not you're actually going to see it. But if you're there when it takes place and you do the right thing at the right time, you can often as not catch you some hellish damn good fish.
Well, another question we have from, you did mention lines there, and Gary Powell in Memphis wants to know, what is Snobie line and why do you like it so much?
Oh, Snobie is a line that's produced in the United Kingdom. A lot of the techniques that I fish are obviously more so related to historical techniques that we use back there in the United Kingdom. That's one thing. But the main answer to that question is that I like white lines, strange enough. And now a lot of people will argue, white lines spook and frighten fish. I don't buy that, and I never have. If there's anything that'll spook or frighten a fish, it's what we do to try and catch it. And aerializing the line above a fish and creating shadow and various issues like that, or even just the audible sound when the line hits the water, will spook wary fish. I also like that line because it's extremely supple. You know, a lot of the fly lines out there today, and I'm not saying they're not good lines because they are, but they're more wiry, they're more stiff in nature. And because of a lot of the techniques that I use, they don't really suit that. Let's put it to you like that. I also like a line that's very supple because it tends to move much more so at the mercy of natural stream movement. You know, you just get these little kind of twists and drifts in the way the surface of the water moves. It's never constant. And if you have a line that kind of works like a snake with that, it's actually a lot easier to maintain real perfect dead drift control, particularly when you're fishing dry flies or emergers and flies of that nature. So really, that is my main reasons for preference for that particular line. Rio makes some pretty damn nice lines that come close to that too.
You said sinking lines. Do you use sinking tip or do you use the intermediate sinking lines at all?
All three.
Yes,
depending on the techniques. I use intermediate lines, which may be anything from 1 to 2 IPS, you know, 3 to 4, 5 to 6, 7 to 8, just depends. Sink tip lines are very, very useful on this river system, particularly for drift fishing with a boat, running shorelines, casting into the shore with streamers and working them off. Most times a brown trout's going to whack you. He's going to do it usually within 4 feet, 6 feet at the most. It's the instant he sees that fly, his reaction to turn around and get it. The longer he follows the fly, the less chance you've got to catch him. So sink tip lines with different sink rates and different lengths of sink heads probably if I was to give one line I would choose more than any other, it would be a 12-foot head with about a 4 to 6 IPS sink rate. Intermediate lines I would tend to use more for shallow water fishing, particularly when you're wade fishing.
Okay, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about flies here. Of course, everybody wants to know, you know, Marvin Carley in Calgary, Alberta,
yeah,
as well as several other people. What's your favorite fly, or what are the top five flies that you'd have in your box? Can you kind of address that? Because there must be a top five that you have that you like.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I would always answer this question, that if you carry a selection of flies that in some way or other represent the major food sources found in any particular river system that you fish, you're probably halfway, if not more, toward enabling yourself to catch those fish. So if you take the White River system, for example, you're dealing with, as I said, major food base being crustaceans. Therefore, you would have something that would be representative of starbug or scud. There are certain zones on this river where the fish are more likely to feed on starbugs than they are scuds because they're predominating larger numbers. That's the first thing. So definitely a starbug imitation in my book. The second one would be a coronamid, a midge. And I don't necessarily relate that to the fact that it's a midge of size 18, 20, 22, 24 because you fish in only small flies like that here when we've got exceptionally low water situations and the fish are, you know, able to see and feed on that minute food base. Albeit, midge hatch here in massive numbers every day of the week, more so at night. But in high water, the fish don't see them. So I use a fly I developed called a super midge, which essentially is a midge pupa, but it's not a size 18. It's more, I generally fish those more size 12 and size 14s. And overall, they are exceptionally consistent fish catchers. There's no doubt about that. The next fly that I would choose to use, and I'm speaking in a generalization here for the guys that want to come and fish here, probably would be a olive woolly bugger, because that represents a lot of the food base that's here. It represents sculpins, represent crawdads. And it is a good, consistent fish-catching fly. No question about that. The next fly I would tell somebody always to have in their possession would be probably an elk hair caddis. And I think that's nationally recognized as one of the best all-round general-purpose dry flies to use. And so far as the fifth fly, that's kind of a difficult question, to be honest about it. I would probably, if I was going to orientate that more so to catching trophy brown trout, it would be a large streamer, and it would probably be a large black marabou muddler, to be honest about that.
Okay, okay. Chris Morris, and I think we had another question here about soft tackles. Do you use soft tackles?
Oh, yes, period. You know, I come from country where the traditions of, by definition, wet fly fishing and soft tackles, of course, have their origination. Soft tackles more so in the North Country regions of the United Kingdom, and what we call traditional wet flies, which differ largely to the kind of wet flies that evolved here in the United States, have more so their origins from Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. In fact, when I first came here to the river system here in Arkansas, and I'd fished here a number of times before I actually came to live here with my friend Dave Whitlock, I kind of got to looking, you know, about the way people fished here, you know, and the techniques they used, and pretty much they were all within a small zone of thought, if that's the way to explain that. Well, of course, my own personal experience fishing with wet flies and soft tackles led me to think, well, you know what, I'm going to spend more time doing that here, and I did, and actually, and the consequence of that was that I produced the DVD Wet Fly Ways, because I really wanted the American public to become a little bit more aware of how valuable and effective traditional wet fly techniques are. And certainly soft tackles have a place where that's concerned. They, you know, I obviously don't have the time to discuss that because I could do a whole show with you about that one anyway, but there are many techniques that apply to the application of fishing soft tackles or wet flies. And of course, except by definition, we're referring to a fly that is subsurface. Although my own personal interpretation of a wet fly is a specific style of fly, and obviously that being more so related to how I value the traditional values of what, for from where I come from, a wet play is all about. But I will say this, that probably in my book, the most effective way to largely catch fish on soft tackles is with a dead drift upstream mode. In other words, you fish in those flies as though they're representing a food base coming naturally towards the fish, the direction they would naturally expect the food source to come to them. Casting across stream and stripping wet flies back, it catches fish. I can't argue with that. But it's not how I personally see the art of fishing a soft tackle, if I can explain it in that sense of the word, because there's virtually no stream insect that comes across the stream at 30 mile an hour. The exception might be, the exception might be a caddis that gets blown across stream, but largely any natural food source does not move across the current like that.
Right.
And therefore, I tend to fish those flies in teams of three and sometimes four. And I know there's a question there related to that.
Why don't you address that? Yeah, I think Martin Coleman and Lawrence Callis, he said, wants to know what your three-fly setup is for the white. And, you know, what do you put on there and how far apart do you put them? And why don't you explain how your actual technique of how you would fish that?
Yeah. Okay. Well, first and foremost, I use long rods, 10 or 11 foot on average, which carry anything from a 3 to 5 weight line on average for river fishing. And the long rod does a number of things. It facilitates you to be able to control the flies at range. It also allows you to do things that you can't effectively do in the same way with the short rod. Furthermore, we're using a long leader system. The manner in which I make my leader systems up is somewhat different to what most people would think. I pretty much typically use the same diameter of line from the fly line to the tail fly. If I'm fishing three flies, the end fly would be called the tail fly, the fly in the middle would be called the dropper or middle dropper, and the top fly we call the top dropper or the bob fly. And if I have another fly above that, where the two intermediate flies would both be dropper flies. The average spacing that those flies would be set apart would be something in the region of never less than 24 inches and probably more on an average more like 30 inches. And they'd be tied on tag droppers, which are in the region of at least 4 inches, but not generally much more than 6. So if you take an average of 4.5 to 5 inches, and you do that by typically tying a surgeon's knot, and you use only the lower dropper, the lower tag for your dropper fly. In other words, when you've tied that knot, if you're looking at your tail fly and you're going up, we call that a cast, incidentally, a cast of flies. It's not the termination of the actual physical act of casting. But shall we say this, you're going up the leader and you come to the junction where you've tied that surgeon's knot, you're going to have an upper tag and a lower tag. And it is always the lower tag that you tie your dropper flies to. The other thing about a long rod like that of the right action is it throws a very slow, deliberate line and lessens the tangles that you're likely to get if you try to do the same thing with a fast action rod. And you don't need that for that style of fishing anyway. The art of fishing flies like that is to present them in such a way as they look lifelike to the fish's eyes. And they're caricatures. But saying that, you know, a lot of the flies that we use typically, a wing wet hare's ear. I mean, that fly, if you fish that fly during a caddis hatch, it's a killer. They have flies like woodcock and yellow, woodcock and orange, and a lot of flies that, you know, guys here are generally not that too familiar with. I know a lot of people are fairly familiar with soft tackles like partridge and orange, partridge and hare's ear, partridge and yellow, that kind of stuff. And they're all really good, you know, standard, traditional, by definition, soft tackles and all flies within the wet fly category. How I would choose to arrange those flies on any given day again, that's something I could spend hours and hours talking about, but it very much relates to a number of different things. Primarily, a time of year, the conditions of the water I'm having to deal with, what available food source is there, are there any fish showing up or near to the surface, determining what depth I would fish those flies at. Generally, I'm going to be looking for what I call slower water zones as opposed to fast water zones, because slower water zones, generally the fish see more food base off the main current seams in those, and those flies work a little bit better in slower water zones. That's not to say if you're fishing a riffle, that a shallow water riffle, that fish are, you know, in that you won't put them off the surface or just below it with those flies, because you will. So there are really a lot of issues that relate to what I would choose to use at any given point of time on any particular zone on the river. And it changes, you know, what I might use, for example, on this section may differ to what I would use lower down. The only thing I would add about that is on the White River system in our trophy zones, and one of those is at Bull Shoals Dam, the other one is at Rim Shoals, and there's another one on the Norfolk River system, and there's two more below. We are only legally allowed to use a single barbless hook fly. I don't quite know the logic in that one, to be perfectly honest about it, but so be it, that's the regulation. But wet fly fishing and soft tackle techniques on our river systems are exceptionally effective, and I see more and more people fishing that way than certainly they did when I first came here. So,
just to clarify, when you said so, everybody is very clear on this. When you've got, let's say, your cast of three flies, to keep it simple, the tag or end fly is tied directly to your tippet. The top and the dropper in the middle are tied to the extended tag of a surgeon's knot. So they're extended, what, you said 4 inches off the line?
Yeah, okay. Let me just explain that a little bit further. Say, for example, I was going to fish on some shallow water, say on average about 18 inches, maybe 2 foot depth, and I want those flies to work somewhere within 6 inches to maybe 12 inches below the surface, okay? Now, I know that I can easily achieve that depth with three flies with an upstream and or across initial presentation and let those flies dead drift. So I would make up my system something along these lines. From the end of that fly line, I'm going to have probably 6 feet of continuous line, just say 4X, and then I'm going to make up my sections either continuous of 4X, and or if I'm going to fish smaller flies, I may reduce that down from 4X to 5X. So it's not really so much a system like where you have a tapered leader and you add tippet to it. You basically make the entire system up either with the same diameter of line or a 1X reduction. So I may fish 4 pound line right the way through, 5 pound, 6 pound, just largely depending on what I was doing. And that's kind of difference really from the standard approach of using a leader and then adding tippet to it and then whatever. And sometimes I might use a leader system total from the fly line to the tail fly. That may be up to 15 feet. It largely depends on where I am and how I want those flies to be presented to the fish. I would just say this, that the longer the length of filament you use from the fly line of a finer diameter, the more imitatively those flies fish to that fish's eye, because they're not hindered by the restriction of, shall we say, either the weight of the fly line or the weight of the fly line and how it is controlled by water surface. In other words, the further you are away, the more difficult it is to keep the line off the surface of the water without adversely causing drag to your flies. Because if you raise the rod, then the weight of the line itself will tend to cause the flies to come back towards you. So there's a lot to it, and it's kind of really hard to explain that one, really, on a talk show. But
that's the reason for tying them off the line onto the tags is to give them more freedom of natural movement.
Absolutely, right. Yeah. You know, and that's a practice I always adopt too. If I fish two fly rigs with, say, nymphs, for example, or even three nymphs, I don't use the scenario of tying one to the other. In other words, you know, I don't tie the fly below the fly above to the bend of the hook or the eye of the hook, because my personal belief is that if you do that, you restrict very much the animation that fly can impart once you're fishing it. And I know for a fact, because, you know, frequently I have two anglers fishing at one time. And, you know, when you're a guide, you can kind of do things and figure things out, and your customers help you do that. So, you know, you could fish one guy with the same flies rigged up one way. You can fish another guy with the same flies rigged up another way and see which one is more productive. And various things like that, you learn that. But I have to say also that, you know, coming from where I am from, the use of, shall we say, tying one fly to another was, no one does that. They pretty much use detached droppers all the time because it gives the fly much more freedom of movement. And I'll also argue that the fish can get that fly easier in its mouth. When it goes to take a fly, shall we say, that's tied above and below, the odds are that fish's snout's going to hit that filament before it gets the fly in its mouth. When you think about that logically, how it drifts along. And I've watched fish refuse flies. The one thing about the White River, I tell you, is that it's an exceptionally gin-clear water system most of the time. And when you're in a boat, you can see the fish, and you can also see their reactions to the flies. You know, and of course, with my customers, I'm watching what's going on all the time, and they're generally looking at something else. Possibly they're looking at an indicator if they're fishing an indicator. I'm not looking at their indicator. I'm looking at where I know that fly is, where I can see those fish, and often I can tell them, hey, raise the rod, fish eat the fly. Well, how do you know that? And I says, because I saw it do it. Well, they didn't move the indicator. It doesn't matter. It ate your fly. You know, it can eat your fly and spit it out without even moving that indicator at times. And it gives you the advantage of watching behavioral patterns of those fish and how they are. And it's fascinating. You know, I think if you take on an average day's fishing, maybe for every one fish you catch, you probably there's probably 5 or maybe 10 fish that refuse to take your fly because they move out of the way, maybe an inch to the left, an inch to the right. You know, that's an interesting scenario. You just really do not know what's going on below the surface of that water when your flies pass, unless you're sight fishing for fish and you can actually physically see them.
Let's talk about fishing for browns and or rainbows with streamers, and maybe you can explain some of the techniques you use regarding that. We had several questions regarding using – one was involving how do you choose your sink rate for fly line, and then, you know, using streamers or those kind of patterns for the big browns.
Okay. Well, you're largely dealing with two different species of fish. You know, particularly brown trout. I mean, they are very different fish, and I've always looked at brown trout that way. In fact, I never caught a rainbow trout till somewhere in the 70s because the places I fish contain only natural wild brown trout. And so their behavioral characteristics are exceptionally different. You know, by definition, brown trout, as we all know, are generally much more aggressive species of fish than rainbow trout. Brown trout will go look for their food base while rainbows wait for it to come to them. In river systems, largely in lakes, that's a kind of different scenario. How I choose and determine which line I'm going to use, particularly here on the White River system, is based on this, is the water, the depth and the speed of the water, and how you want that fly to be presented to those fish. So, for example, if you're fishing on, just say an average depth of maybe, say, 3 to 4 feet of water, and you're working shorelines, and you've got a fairly medium pace of water, would I opt to fish an ultra-fast sinking line? No, probably not. The odds are there I can get away with fishing a sink tip line because I know that within generally 4 feet, if there's a fish there and he sees that fly, he's going to get it. On the other hand, if I was fishing faster water and I want that fly to get down a little deeper, then the odds are I would have to use the full sinking line to enable that to happen because of depth and speed. But I have to also say that that's somewhat also related to how your boat is being drifted down that water. If you're running down the river at the same pace as the current, then as you cast across stream, as your boat's moving downstream, your line is sinking down pretty darn deep, particularly when you're using a fast sinking line. If, however, you're fishing a slower water zone and you're out in the river system where the water's running faster, well, the boat's moving downstream, but your fly and your fly line is probably going to be more upstream, and you pull it back at a different angle. So you orientate, to some extent, the fly line that you use in relation to a depth of water, speed of water, and the relationship of the boat drifting downstream to the zone that you're fishing. It's not so much the fly. You know, you can get away with at times fishing, say, a size 10 olive woolly bugger. On the other hand, you may choose to fish something in the region of 4 to 5 to 6 inches long. But I've seen it happen both times. You know, I've seen big brown trout eat very small streamer flies like woolly buggers, and I've seen big brown trout eat big, big flies, albeit they're fished on the same lines. So a lot of the questions that people do ask like that really are related to at that particular point of time and in the prevailing conditions and where you are fishing, what the best options of choice are, and one or the others will be the best. So the difference between, shall we say, fishing a fast sinking line and say an intermediate with a one or two IPS differs with the same fly, the same length of leader. Typically, I would add this too, that with faster sinking lines, you're generally fishing short leader systems at maybe 2 to 3 feet, something like that. And objectively, what you're going to do is you're going to present that fly to where you expect the fish to be. As soon as it gets to the water, you maybe just allow a little, what we call settle the fly, and then you whip it back. Sink tips allow you a wider scope of margin in as far as that's concerned, because you can mend the line. So if you cast across stream, you can mend upstream the floating part of your sinking line, sink tips, excuse me, which, and of course at that time, the fly line is still sinking, the fly is still sinking. But when you start to retrieve, you create a different relative angle of recovery. In other words, the difference between casting the fly straight across stream to the shoreline and ripping it back in one straight line is one thing, but using a sink tip, for example, casting across stream, allowing the lie to track downstream, creating a back, what we call a downstream belly, and pulling the fly back, by that definition, the fly comes off the shoreline around in a curve. And you may find on certain days that one or the other is more likely to promote a take than the other. And typically where rainbows are concerned, rainbows absolutely love a fly that swings around in a curve. Brown trout will do it also, but my experience is by and large, brown trout, they want that fly instantly in their sight and wham, they're going to get it pretty darn quick as soon as you start to retrieve, maybe 30 seconds. Whereas rainbows will have the habit of following that fly, and I've watched them do it hundreds and hundreds of times. They'll follow it downstream. And then as the fly turns around and comes back toward you, wham, just on that angle of turn, they hit it.
Well, based upon what you just said, Davey, do you how do you retrieve then? Because you say the browns may get it within the first, you know, 3 or 4 feet of retrieve, right?
Yeah.
But then you may pick up a rainbow later in the retrieve. Do you do a full retrieve all the time, or when do you do just partials and pick up and move again?
Okay. Yeah. What I tend to do is this. I just know from experience and instinct that there's certain retrieves that are more likely to get a brown trout to respond to, particularly within, you know, the first, like I said, the first 4 feet, than likely a rainbow. Because they're like a snake when it grabs a mouse. I mean, it's like as fast as your eye can see it, if you see it, that's how they are. Whereas rainbows have more of a curiosity to follow a fly for long periods of time and still take it, which is generally not the case with browns. Browns, generally speaking, if they're going to eat your fly, particularly a streamer fly fished off a shoreline, and it doesn't really matter whether you're wade fishing and or boat fishing, either one, they're generally going to do it real quick. They lose interest very fast because I guess they figured out that it ain't right. Whereas, like I said, the comparison of difference between rainbows is they will follow a fly for an awful long time, yet still eat it. I've seen rainbows, when we've been fishing, follow a fly 30, 40, 50 feet. And then eat that fly within 5 or 6 feet of the boat. I'm not saying you won't have a brown trout do that now and again, but that's not a common occurrence. Mm-hmm. Most times, if you're going to hook that brown, it's going to be pretty darn quick once that fly has landed. Now, so far as retrieves are concerned, again, that is somewhat related to the speed and depth of water, the fly line you're using, whether you're wade fishing or whether you're in the boat. And you'll find on any given day, and I know this is a strange scenario, but really is some, shall we say, fact to it, that there's a certain retrieve that on that particular day is much more productive than the other. So you may find, for example, on one day, cast the fly, and you make one real long strip, as far as you can strip it, 3 to 4 feet, whatever, whoom. And as soon as you instantly stop that strip, that's when the fish hit you. Then on another day, you may be there and you cast and you make shorter, faster strips of, say, 12 to 15 inches, doop, 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 and that's when they hit it. You've just got to find out on any particular day what it is those fish want. And that's another way you can prove that theory to some extent is just, for example, say we drift 1 mile of shoreline and you know, and I know there's some fish there. And we worked it, we didn't get an offer. Well, it could maybe that in the case of brown trout, they're not interested to feed. But we may have pulled a few smaller rainbows off. We go back upstream again. We don't necessarily change the lines, neither the flies. But what we do is we come back downstream again, and we fish with a different technique of retrieve. And you may well find that that proves to be more positive than the one that you previously used. And it may be a longer strip, shorter, faster strips. It just has to do with the way that fly moves and how the fish sees it and is aggressive towards that movement more than anything else.
Well, that's very interesting. And unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to make a couple notes because I've learned a few things here tonight myself. And one of the things you said, well, I always learn something, but
yeah.
One of the things you said earlier on, you said, you know, the more, basically, I'll just paraphrase you, but you said, you know, the more experience, the more time on the water, the more fishing you do, the better you will get. And I think what you just described kind of portrays that whole scenario of, you know, to be good and to get those fish, you got to be on that water a lot or be with somebody that's been on that water a lot to be highly successful. And the other thing that we always get questions on the show about, well, what's the best fly or what are your five top flies? And you kind of nailed it on the head earlier when you said, I think what the question should be asked all the time is, what are the primary food sources in the river? And not what fly is best, right? And then you can better focus on what fly is best once you've identified the food sources.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think I did say that. My answer would be that on any particular river system, there has to be largely a predominance of food base there that those fish key into probably 90% of their daily lives. And if you carry with you a selection of flies that in some way or other generally represent the major food sources, then you're about probably 75% more so toward catching those fish. And there was one fly, incidentally, that I failed to suggest there, and that would be a hare's ear nymph. To me, when nymphs are concerned, that is absolutely my number one period fly for any system in the world. It doesn't matter whether it's a stream or a reservoir or whatever, you know.
That's always been my fly. When nothing else works, I go to that, and for some reason I always catch fish.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's just got an intrinsic value about it. It represents a whole bunch of different invertebrate food sources.
Well, we'll end on one final question, since you did give us one more favorite fly. We got a question in over the Internet. Herb Kettler in River Forest, Illinois says, Davey, what did you catch your 25-pound brown on?
Oh, on a streamer. On that black muddler streamer.
Black muddler streamer.
Yeah, all it is, it's you can tie that on usually I tie them on about a size 2 or a size 4 hook. It's a black chenille body if you choose to want to do that, or a dubbing material, either one. You wind a red throat to it. It's got either a black marabou wing or a bucktail and a black muddler head. And I think black overall is one of the most productive colors, particularly so when you're fishing in diminished light conditions for brown trout. And that's another thing we didn't really get into, you know, that light prevailing conditions very much are related to how brown trout are likely to respond to techniques of fishing. You know, there's certain techniques that would be more preferential over another in conditions of diminished light. But by and large, my orientation towards fishing in conditions of dusk to dark would be to use dark bias colored flies, particularly where brown trout are concerned.
Well, maybe that's another whole show, Davey, that we can talk about, you know, tactics for trophy browns and include those diminished light situations. That would be an excellent topic. Well, we need to close things out, but stick with us, folks. When we return, we're going to do the drawings for the gifts tonight, and so start trying to anticipate the question I'm going to ask, and we'll be right back and do those drawings. You've likely heard of the proposed Pebble Mine Project in southwest Alaska's Bristol Bay region. This enormous open pit would generate as much as 3 billion tons of toxic waste in a seismic area which is home to the world's largest runs of wild salmon and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing on the planet. The world of fly fishing has rallied to this tremendous cause, but we need your help, too. To learn more or to sign the Bristol Bay Conservation Petition, visit www.sportsmansalliance and then the number 4ak.org. So sportsmansalliance4ak.org. Or just Google Bristol Bay Mining. Get involved. Be proactive. Conservation helps the future of fly fishing. And just a quick reminder to everybody before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback on the show. You'll find the link on our homepage just below the section that says, what did you think of the show? Click on that link and leave your comments. Now it's time to give away the prizes. And that first prize we're going to give away today is on a draw with a drawing. That's a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. Always a great gift to receive. And if you want to find out more about the Federation of Fly Fishers, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. So we'll do a drawing here for that 3-year membership. And our winner is Martin Beach. I know I'm destroying the pronunciation, but Martin, you'll know who I mean. And Martin's in Missouri, so just around the corner. And he'll get that 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. Now, the second gift we have to give away, courtesy of the Mid-South Fly Fishers, they have a book out called Home Waters and of the Mid-South Fly Fishers, and it's an angler's guide to trout streams and rivers of Arkansas, Tennessee, and southern Missouri. It's got a bunch of sections on the different river systems, includes some maps, some fly patterns, all kinds of useful information. So they've offered this up tonight since it's related to our show tonight. And by the way, if you want to get a copy, if you don't win tonight and want to get a copy or look more at what they have to offer, it's www.msff.org, msff.org, and then you can pick up a copy for yourself there as well. Thanks to Gary Powell for that tonight, for offering that up. So let's see who the winner of that is. And it'd be Martin Coleman in Kansas. Martin Coleman in Kansas gets the Home Waters book. So, Martin, you're not too far away to be able to use that book as well. So congrats to you as well. Okay, Davey, we're going to give away that White River DVD that you've put together. And we're going to have to ask a question. We'll make it a little bit difficult tonight because I know we've got a lot of listeners online tonight. And remember, you want to be at the home page of our website. There's a text box there. There's your name and where you're from, and you got to put those in if you want to win the prize. It's not only answer the question right, give us your name and location. And the question, so when I give you this question, put in your answer, and the first person to answer it correctly will win Davey's DVD on the White River, which is... sounds like it's just something you have to have if you're going to go down there fishing. And, Davey, again, your website, for all the people that don't win it, they can go to DaveyWanton.com, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, yeah.
And order a copy there. Okay, so the question is, Davey talked about how he rigs up for wet fly presentations, and he would use several flies, anywhere from 2, 3, 4 flies, and he used a certain term for that grouping of flies. What term did he use for that grouping of flies? And this is something that we're not, I don't think we're, a lot of us are familiar with that term. But we'll see if you've been paying attention. So, Davey, I'm on the website right now waiting for someone to submit that correct answer, and then you can tell me if they get it right. And I do have an answer here. Randy Snide in Bedford. I'm not sure where Bedford is. And he says cast. Was he correct?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's termed as a cast of flies.
Well, there you go, Randy. You won. And the first person that answered got the gift tonight. So, Randy, what you want to do is, in that same text box, send me your email address so that I can contact you. And also, if you can, send your mailing address, contact information, phone number, and so forth. And then we'll have Davey send that out directly to you. So congratulations. At least somebody's paying attention, huh, Davey?
Yeah, he must have been, actually, to pick that one up. Yeah.
Well, yeah. In the past I've asked, what was your favorite fly or something like that. And the last show we had, somebody submitted the answer before I asked the question. So I'm getting a little wiser about asking the question. So.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's great, though. Well, Davey, hey, thanks so much for joining us tonight on the show. It was very interesting and exciting to hear you talk about the White River. I know you're going to get a lot of people come down there visit you now for sure. But
yeah.
We appreciate you talking with us. So hopefully you'll join us again sometime, like we said. Maybe talk about more presentation techniques specifically.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to, talk a little bit more about the history of fly fishing from whence I come. And, that's always been a big part of my fly fishing life, and Might I just add, too, that I will be present at the Housatonic Fly Fishers, which you mentioned earlier on in the show.
Yes.
Sometime this April, and be doing some programs there. So if any of the listeners would wish to contact them and, you know, be present when I'm there, well, I would look forward to see them there.
There you go, folks. Yeah. If you're up in that part of the country, you can talk to Davey then. Well, good. Good information to have. Well, our next broadcast, which will be on February 18th, next week, and thanks, folks, for bearing with me last week, and Davey, you too, for I was really kind of down and out with the cold, but I'm coming back strong now.
Yeah,
but,
well, I stormed and had no power, so we were screwed both ways, I guess. Yeah.
I guess, yeah. Well, next week we're going to have another show, February 18th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern, and on that show we're going to interview Jim Block, and our topic for the show will be Fly Fishing the Boundary Waters. And that's the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness in northern Minnesota. And Jim has guided up there for the past 16 years. And if you want solitude and crazy smallmouth bass fly fishing, you want to listen into this. Jim's going to spill the beans on this great destination. So join us then. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Platte River Fly Shop, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2. That's 888-961-1115, extension 2. And we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.